January 28, 1992. This is Shirley Bradley and Lisa Fine, and we are taping Real Memories. Our subject today is Luis Garcia.
And if you don't have any problems with when,
no big deal.
We'll have to worry about the women, I guess, when we ask that
question.
Yeah,
4/19/21.
And how long were you in Mexico? When did you...
Well, I was in and out of that until I was 2 years old.
Okay.
And then about 2 years, maybe, you know, 30 months, my dad and I went back. So he used to go, my mother used to go back, my dad always stayed here.
Uh-huh.
She came in 1914, so he got his roots in the First World War.
Uh-huh.
But then he never went back because the family started getting big, so from then on I just stayed here.
Uh-huh.
Which is stayed in Gratiot, in the county.
Gratiot County. Oh, what? In the country or in a
country
city?
Country, farm, yeah, a farmer.
And, there was something else I wanted to ask you about that. Did the whole family come at first? Together?
My daughter was first, my mother.
Oh, okay.
And then I got a brother who was born there, and he was about 18 months when he left.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, us two, my mother and dad, they stayed with dad.
Did they come to Michigan? Did they know people here?
No.
They just,
that's the way people travel back then, I think. No, my dad came first to Michigan, I think. 1914, I think, or 16, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he was in the United States before that.
Uh-huh.
But he moved to this, in the first place, was... I mean, he came to Duran, and from there he went to Baldwin, Michigan. Then he came down.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time they were turning the forest, you know, ripping the woods apart. And then he got into farming.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other things was that we had on the list was, let's do with the family first.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to your wife, so I know why. And children?
My children?
You.
I got five.
And your parents were born in Mexico.
Right.
As their parents before them.
Then they great grandparents.
All.
Way down to the permit age.
Okay, and how many brothers and sisters did you have?
There was 13 of us. There was 8 brothers and 8 boys.
Mm-hmm.
8 brothers and 5 girls.
And they all went in children. Well, you were the oldest?
Yeah, I was the oldest, and John was the second. And the other ones all were born here.
Mm-hmm.
We would have been born here, but my mother wanted to be with Mama.
Mm-hmm.
With my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
So she'd go back, see.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd stay there for long enough so I could walk or whatever, I don't know. And then she'd come back and see her husband, and then she, when she got pregnant again, she went back down again, and she went back when she was 18 months.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have the help, I know that.
Yeah. Well, I think she fell most of
the sense. Sure, especially
English,
when you're...
English, she did. My dad spoke English, but my mother was very limited at that time.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't really get to speak English about it during wartime.
Mm-hmm.
So you take 19, 20, 22, 23. If there wasn't a Polish, it was a Russian. If it wasn't a Russian, it was Italian. So they had a time in those areas. Back in them days, there was no English was spoken only in the town. And when we went to visit a house, whatever they were, that's what they were speaking.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you went to school, did you go to school up in Gratiot County,
mm-hmm.
or it was down here in Lansing?
No, country schools.
Country schools.
They don't think you went to school with a big furnace in them. That's how I was educated, and I like it. I still wish they'd teach that way.
Yeah, I know Glenn felt that way too.
More personalized,
yeah.
Yes,
he did.
Don't wish they'd teach that way. One teacher controlled, I mean, she could control.
Mm-hmm.
I got slapped, I got hit my hands, like, put your hands out there, slapped on top.
Oh.
With a ruler.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. So.
Did you go to high school too? Or?
Yeah, in high school, then I finished that in Nick Rattles.
Oh. And you said, I think I remember from the luncheon that you started working at Rio during the war?
No, right after the war.
After the war.
I went to the war first.
Okay.
I got into the Second World War.
Uh-huh.
When I came back, I applied for a job.
So it was 1945, 46?
46.
46.
Boy, it was in May, I think. Because I went to Mexico for a semester of my folks.
Uh-huh. Oh, they were back down there again?
No, I took them down.
Oh, you took them down? That's nice.
I took them down, and then I came back.
Uh-huh.
And played, I think it was in May. I got the record, but I don't know. I played them. Charlie Farrell was the personnel manager at the time. Of course, he's gone now, Charlie Farrell. And he interviewed me, and he says, that I was very qualified, because I think everybody hears that when you're young, you're old.
Because you had gone to college? I mean, to high school?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was graduating. I started service, and I went to the non-com school. I went to all kinds of schooling there, too.
Yeah.
And then I went in there, and he was so qualified. I said, what do you mean, well, qualified?
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, I want to work. I don't care what it is. You want me to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it was hard after the war.
I said, I don't go by the what I got. Qualifications, and then about 10 with you know. You put me in the door, and I'll tell you what I'll do after that.
Uh-huh. And what did they put you on?
They put me in, the first thing was a little dinky room that they cut bar steel. And it was dirty and dusty and everything.
Cut bar steel.
Mm-hmm. Cutting the steel, put the bar steel. A lot of bar. It was heavy bars, short bars, and a big pedal machine. It wasn't big. To me, it was a machine. They cut, it probably was a 75-ton press cutting the machine. But anyway,
can you feed the bars into it?
Yeah, a certain length, given dimension. You type, they wrote your cheek, you know, so much dimension. Except that's nothing for me, because I already knew a lot of that stuff through schooling or through working. Because I worked in the press area in Seattle, Washington, when I was in service.
Oh.
I used to sneak out to work without you.
You did?
Yeah. Oh, you especially should do anything for a dollar.
You heard there was some employment there, so you did that on moonlighted and did
yeah.
that?
Yeah.
Oh,
that was in Seattle, in Tacoma, Washington, both places. I get several little plants in there, and I got to work. So, but I already knew how to, you know, get a scale and all that stuff. That's all you need for that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So they put the work there, and then I guess the supervisor thought it was pretty good, so they moved me out of there. And
what did you start at? What pay did you mean?
What pay?
Yeah, pay did you start at? How much per hour?
Oh, it's money. It was piecework, but they started you at 90 cents or 85 cents an hour. I'd have to look back.
Mm-hmm.
It was real cheap an hour. I mean, it was good money. I mean, all that money, you could buy a car over there. I mean, it's 85 cents an hour. So then I went out of there and I got into the 90 cents an hour, or 92 cents an hour, into the press, or what they call the press division. So it is just a little cutoff room, I guess, from where they bought this raw material into there and cut it and then send it in to the press area for machine areas after it was cut the length.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of acute. I can remember. I can still see it. So they put me in the press division in there. And then I started working what they call helpers.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they used to use the word tailing, the tail that operated. And then pretty soon I was really operating. So then one day they asked me if I could set up a die, you know. So I said, sure. I set that thing up.
Mm-hmm.
You sure? You just let me do it and I'll do it for you. I did because I did those little dyes. So these were those bigger, but this was a little in Seattle, Tacoma. So
mm-hmm.
I got in there.
Same kind of basic operation.
The basic thing is just like picking up the phone, you know, talk the same to everybody, just switch languages.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. You know, so the dye's bigger, like different mold or something. Mm-hmm. But it's going to function the same way, same adjustments anyway. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And then send dyes. So then I got promoted to the dye setter. I think that was $1.15 then.
Mm-hmm. And this was all within a few years?
No, it was very short.
Oh, even less than
very that? Very short,
oh.
Yeah. I climbed pretty quick. I didn't go ask. They just must have seen the performance.
Uh-huh.
I was a nice head of great. And then, you know, I had a rough time. Me, any young guy, because he's old timer, he just couldn't.
That you were moving up.
You couldn't touch it. Yeah, you couldn't touch the machine. That was their machine.
I see.
Every machine had a name. Mm-hmm. I remember some of the
calls. A nickname?
Yeah, them, their
that
name.
They made up,
like,
yeah.
Like Mary Matoon, that machine was called Matoon, the Matoon machine.
Oh.
I always remember Mary Matoon. You know, Gaylord Wilson, which is Gaylord Wilson, we all tell him, Gaylord Wilson was the old setup man, the old leader, like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you couldn't tell him nothing.
These are old-timers from the 20s, 30s.
Was already, yeah. And ready to retire in the next 5, 6 years,
I
or
see.
10, you know. And
so here comes this young upstart.
Yeah, here I come, young upstart. And what do you know about this? And get the heck out of my way. Oh, me, used to. I just didn't pay attention, I think. And then one day he's tightening up a ram, and the nuts were about 3.5-inch diameter nuts up there. And he said something about, he was always being snotty to me, so he said to me, okay, can you help me tighten up that nut, or can you tighten that nut? Sure, I can. I said, but I can break it off for you if you want me to. Don't be smart, you can't break it off. So I give her a yank, and I broke that inch and a half diameter bolt.
Oh,
no,
my goodness.
I mean, I couldn't break it off.
I think you like a challenge.
Well, he was always mouthing up at me, see?
Yeah.
I'm a whippersnapper, I was a straw boss, I was everything. Because I was a young guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When he told me I couldn't break it, I just delayed the machine that much longer. Break it, stud out, put a new stud in.
Oh, Lord.
Well, you blend it the same way. Probably you've done some things you shouldn't have done. But
yeah.
Well, we taught them old buggers something, you know. I had a rough time. I never forget what we. But you learn from them.
Mm-hmm.
I took that. That's the way I started looking at it. I don't learn from these knuckleheads. I call them knuckleheads. Much of a knucklehead what you guys are. But from you, I'm going to learn without you even teaching me.
Uh-huh. You can just observe.
Sure. I said, I may not use your language, but I'll tell you one thing, I'll learn whatever you got on top of, you know, whatever. Because they didn't want to teach you nothing.
They felt threatened, I
Yeah, they felt threatened, yeah. They call that job security in them days. And I didn't believe it. I believe in teaching everybody, and everybody's got the same job security.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one that performs the best is the one that they're going to keep anyway.
Sure.
So we went in there. So then from there on, I have to look at my records. Then they make what they call a straw boss, a real straw boss.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for a while, and then they put me on foreman. Well, though I went to the tool and die room, they picked me up and put. So I took 2 years, 2.5 years of tool and die room. That's when this Mr. Zimmer came.
Zimmer, I was going to ask you about him. And he's the one that picked you out.
Yeah, he told me I got to pull you out of here. And I didn't want to, because I want to finish and get my journeyman card, which was 5 years training, see? And I think I'd have to look at my paper, but I think it's about 2.5 years,
mm-hmm.
which is good. Because the basic things are taught in the 2.5 years. From then on, most of the other 2.5 or 2 years is mostly actual internship, like you're really applying everything and reviewing back what you learned.
Mm-hmm.
So when you graduated, or when you received your certificate 5 years away, you learned it both ways, by studying and by actual application.
Mm-hmm.
But he pulled me on about, it was about 2.5 years. Then they put me on supervision, which then there wasn't a straw boss. Now you went on salary.
Mm-hmm.
Straw boss was on hourly.
Right.
So I went on straw boss, then I went on salary, and then I kept going. Mm-hmm.
How did those old guys think about you when you became the supervisor?
I had a little whack. Like this. Little. So they had what they call the power hammer department. And all they did is hammer the materials.
Uh-huh.
It was an art. You don't have those arts anymore. There's a lot of them gone, but the power hammer, there was 8 old geezers in there. I mean, to me, they were old. They wouldn't have been old if they'd been nice, but to me, they were old. And old Hank Forsman was in there. He just passed away 3 years ago, 90-something years old. He told me that, he says, I'm more or less three desk group, he says, and you just can't do too much. You're not about a straw boss, and you just get your little butt over there. And he didn't even say it, but get over in that other department, and you stay over there, and you just watch us from over there.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do the work and all this and all that. Well, I could go in there and line them up and do what to do, you know, the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, well, I'll be here in the morning. I says, every morning. And I'll be here at noon, I'll be here in the afternoon before you go home. first I'll give you the schedule, then I'll review it at noon, and then I'll check it out, and I'll check it when you go home. See any problems, I'm still going to tell you about it. Yeah.
Doesn't have anything else better to do at the time.
So, I don't know what happened, but they give me a rough time, I don't know, I think it's the third or fourth week, and he did. And you know, got an uproar. And they said, well, we're just going to walk out of the job. I said, I'll tell you what, you guys all get the hell out of here. I don't need any of them. And they walked out. And boy, the superintendent comes down. Do you know what happened? I says, yeah. They said they want to walk out. I told them, get the hell out of here. I'll run this division. I'll run it if I have to do it myself. It's a union or no union. But you ain't never done this. Hey, you'd be surprised what I could do. You just... So I went and got another guy, Ernie Cavis. He's still probably around, Ernie Cavis. And I got some guys that I associated with, you know, they were young guys, looked like me. But, can't remember the other young guy's name. I brought him in there, there's three of us, car myself. We would hammer those down parts to keep the line going. And we did. Kept going, kept going. And I put some more, finally I had about five or six people in there. With myself, and then something went wrong. That they have a leather that just strap it goes in the head. It's a leather strap, and you thread that, and that's the one that gives you the cushion of the hammer. And so it takes the impact and does the whole thing. The operation when it vibrates. So then Ernie comes in. How you want to thread that? You ever thread one of them? Ah, I said, no problem. Oh yeah, so that's an art. I said. All we gotta do is look at that one that isn't busted and look at this and do the same thing. We'll get it. Don't worry, you watch me. I said, I'll do it and then you learn. Let those old buggers tell you you can't do it. See.
Did you ever have any problems from the union for letting those men go?
No, I go to somebody, I'll answer. You just send them to me. Don't argue with them. Because I want to handle them people. I says, they're working for me, I'm going to handle them. I'm going to take care of them. So then, in the meantime, while I was doing all this and trying, barely making the meet in the line, I guess I started getting calls from Hank at home. Louis says, I'm ready to talk. I'm still going to talk and get ready to settle this hump. He says, you must have production down. Oh, no, we're running beautiful. There's no problems at all. In fact, we're ahead of production. You know, like, he couldn't come in because they walked out. See.
Oh.
But he could check by call, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew that the line wasn't going down. That's all I was going to tell him. How would he know if I had a few pieces hit someplace?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Who would know? So we're running real good. I don't really need you. Well, I'm really ready to talk. I said, you might be ready, but I'm not. I'm too busy. And I played it like that for about 3 or 4 days. Then he said he was going to get the union to get into it. I said, you get the union, get anybody. I don't care who you get. I said, when you come back, I said, you're coming under my conditions.
Mm.
No more of this, you know, that I'm this and I'm that. I am the one who's going to run the department. I'm not going to boss you or mistreat you, but you're going to listen to what I got something to say. Yeah, so they finally settled that down. In the meantime, I trained these guys. I said, none of us knew anything about nothing, but we trained ourselves for it. And then it's quite an art. I mean, you have to. It takes about an hour or 2 hours to explain how that metal is. You got to shrink it, know how to shrink it, how to extend it, and still control the dimensions of the hood top or whatever you make in the fender.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't make it humpy like this. You got to make it the same as the print calls for. See, this is an awful art. But we learn that all the day. We got to take it easy. We really will take our time to ruin a piece. See. And we did it, but then they come in, and then we had a meeting actually with the union. And I still told my superintendent, don't say nothing, I'll do the talking. Don't get me, because you might say something, I said, they want to fire them up again. Not that I care, I said, we can settle it. I said, these guys are all right. They're not all right, they just think they're know everything. I said, don't worry about it. So we settled, and they come back, and Hank Porter, I tell you, he was the best friend from there on. Well, he died last year. He always sent me a nice card. He was beautiful, right? He sent me, he says, you know, and never, every time he sent a letter, he says, don't ever forget who you was the best boss we've ever known in anything.
He always kept it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He changed his tune, I tell you. But he was a smart man. I couldn't take it away from Carl Bishop, the other Hammer man. He was a smart man. The other, all them guys that worked there were old, but they were smart because mm-hmm. they had a trade.
And lots of experience. You couldn't blame them
to be the way they were, because it took them probably all their life to know what they knew.
Mm-hmm.
They were not graduates of Michigan State or, you know, it's at that college down there, agriculture college. They were not graduates of anything. They come up the hard way. Some of them didn't even have 8th grade education.
Yeah.
And you take Robert Webster, he was what you call a wire beater machine, a wire beater operator. That's the one that put the beater in the fenders, you know, around the thing.
Hmm.
Well, that was an art. Yeah, I stuck my nose in that one too. I learned how to wire tools. I might have ruined a couple, but I learned how to do it. And, but it was an art. You realize that it's an art, and those guys was proud, because without a mark or anything, they could wire the whole thing all the way through without any marks. I mean, just because they had, see, like running a sewing machine, they had that nice feel.
Mm-hmm.
They knew how fast that machine went, and that's the art. And you control with a foot pedal down here.
Wow.
So it's, you know, you couldn't take it away from him. And that man, that's flat wire man, that's all he done for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wire beater. You ask some young man now, what's a wire beater?
Yeah,
you
know what you're talking about.
You wouldn't even know what a machine would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so I also got into that one. But not because of Bob Webster. Bob Webster was a nice old man. But he got sick on me, I think, after he had an operation. And like I told you, they never wanted to teach nobody else. And
they wanted to keep
some of them no follow-up. Yeah. And so I got stuck into that one, too, and I trained two or three young people to do that.
Hmm.
I had it. If I wasn't there, I said, just not do it. Just run the sewing machine. Just practice on raw material, you know, not a fender or a hood side, which called, you know, the hood side has a radius with it in the old days, what they call it,
uh-huh.
the butterfield opened up like a,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they got a bead on that back in them days. Now they don't put it there. They made the fender, the hood top real sturdy. But we practice on metal so they can learn to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard. The rest, like your tool and dice setup and press adjustments and all that. There was it's those skills that they had, like hammer people and even a toggle press operator. You have to know exactly how that metal flows, or you'll make a wood piece. You break it. So those had to be watched and learned. Learn from them old buggers that were from me.
Now you were not supervisory for a few years. You know, when you first got into the plant, did you join the union then?
No,
you didn't.
I think they made me. That's another problem. When I went in there, you had 90 days or 120. I forget what it was.
To decide, or before you had to.
Before you had to. Well, then I didn't know you had to.
Was it check off?
Yeah, they come over and threatened me. They told me that I had to join or something, and not the cloth union.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't like that. Well, one bit.
Yeah. Did they check it off? In other words, did they check it out of your pay anyway, whether you wanted it or not?
Eventually.
They checked off.
But they come and ask you first, and I told them I didn't want to be that.
Yeah.
I said, I'm a farmer. I don't believe in anybody. But I said, I'll do my own bag. But it didn't work. They had to take in their superintendent called me, and he said, no, you got to sign it. But you won't be long, he says, which I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
You won't be long. Just sign a paper and tell me what I have or something, whatever you want. Mm-hmm. So I already told him that. I said, listen, tell me that. So I was never... You know,
not very involved or anything.
No.
And then once you were a supervisor, it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I was never. I was just a farmer. I didn't like anybody telling me nothing unless he knew more than I did. And I like that woman.
Did you have many problems with labor?
Unions
after you became supervisor? Not at a personal level, but I mean, did you have...
Oh, yeah, they wrote me up. I had grievances against me. They threatened this and threatened that. But I got away. I had ways of it. I had one guy one time. You know, I got away with some stuff. That one, he gave me a rough time, and I caught him in a corner. And he was a steward. He's all he was. He'd just been infected. He's a new guy. I can't even think of his name now. I mean, I'll think of it. Anyway, he was giving me a rough time. You know, he was hot to show the people what a steward he was going to be, and all that good stuff. And finally, I got him. And I says, you don't know me. He says, not really. I says, I don't know you too well. I said, but I'll tell you one thing. I want to eliminate you. Mm. I says, I belong to the Mexican Mafia.
Oh, oh no.
Really mean eliminate.
I said, without nobody ever knowing, you're going to be eliminated.
Oh.
Unless you either, you straighten up. Or,
I think he was scared, right?
You know what he did?
No.
Yes, I don't know. I think he thought it over for an hour, and pretty soon everybody's going to pick up his dinner pill and never get back.
Oh, my. Oh, for heaven's sake.
I get rid of a steward.
While you're speaking of steward, that makes me think maybe I can just ask you a quick question. What is the structure in the shop? Is it from steward? What does it go to? The chain of command?
Well, usually it's a steward. Then a committee man, then a committee man at large, then, well, it depends, but our company just said, I think, steward, the committee man at large, then they went to the president.
Ooh. Of the local?
Yeah, the local.
Of the local.
That was where they could have redress for problems. It could go to one person and then
up the line.
Yeah, they didn't call, the steward is the one that gave you the most titties. They didn't call the committee man until they were going to negotiate or some move, some big drastic move beyond the steward's control. The steward is more like an overseer around it, but sometimes they get big-headed somehow because they're radicals. I always call them radicals. usually if he got too radical, I get the committee man. But if it's a new one like that one, I eliminate him somewhere or other. But if he's a regular good worker who's been there a good long time, I mean, and he just got a little bit out of control, and I just looked at the committee and I said, you will straighten that guy out, because if you don't, I will. You know, it can be done. I mean, they're not that. They just, you get some new ones, and then they think, the committee man is usually pretty decent, and so is the president is usually.
Is the committee man a worker too, or not?
Yeah.
He is too?
Well, it depends on the contract, the way it's right. The steward has got to work all the time.
Right, I know.
The committee man, I think, in hours, I think they had to work at least 4 hours.
Okay.
The president don't, but our president always worked. That's
really?
Why. Yeah, Ray. Hey, Glenn, where are you? Ray, gosh, you know, he's a nice guy. I know his name is Raymond. I can't remember his last name. He always wanted, he didn't want to set up there. And the committee man at large, usually they have all day. They just sat in the office. And,
Bureaucrat.
Yeah, but I think our committee man was 4 hours in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pretty good division. I had control of the studio. Every I got along with them until some new ones started coming up. But most of them, nice control, but nice relation with them. Because I knew it just how to handle. You have to know how to handle. You can't, but you can get along the best with them. Yeah, so I spent all that time right in the first division, and there's a big division. See, and then like I told you, or like we saw that over there at the dinner or lunch, I mean, each division was like a neighbor, you know, and then all neighbors were always together. Mm-hmm. But you had an awful good family relation. Person got hurt or got sick, everybody was concerned. You know,
in your group.
In the group. And then the others from find out later, then they check out and see how everybody's coming.
Mm-hmm.
It became, Rio was a real family. That's why it was hard to break up. And even now, you know, they still stick together. But
and did you stay through to the end too? Like,
yeah, I stayed in 1975. What was it? April the 4th, I think it was 5th, I forget the days I got right now, when we walked out. But when they closed the door, we didn't walk out.
Yeah,
I said that the knife fought until the end.
And what was your last position there? Are you still the supervisor?
I'm still superintendent, but that, yeah. The title was superintendent to supervisor, but I was a superintendent attaching unassigned or assigning unattached or something. Because they brought their own, see.
Oh.
But the
the new owners.
Yeah, the Capper.
Yeah.
But
what was his name? His full name?
Capper.
I'm thinking Frank. I don't know if that's right.
Owen? Frank?
Frank P. Frank?
No, no.
No.
I got pictures of him too.
But he was the general manager, or he was the
new owner.
He was the new owner.
He was the one that
ran
the bank
out
of his back.
Mildred Johnson, I always call her the lieutenant. She was the head lady under him.
Mm-hmm.
I think his first name. Tepper's right here from Mount Pleasant. That's where he was born. Mount Pleasant. Claire. In fact, his mother, I think she's still living, he owned that, what's the name of that hotel downtown Claire there?
Oh, the Doherty.
He owned that.
The Doherty, yes, Doherty.
His mother is, he's the owner, but his mother is the one that runs it. I mean, I don't know if she's alive yet or not. But
that's been in the Doherty family for 78 years or
something. Al Capper.
Al Capper.
Yeah. He bought it, but they brought their own. Oh, he didn't. Then he hired his Sandy Eaton, and he was supposed to have been the president. But to me, he was just president and figure of speech. And then he hired all those under speech, but they still couldn't run the press division without me behind it, somewhere in the background. So I became attached and assigned to give me an office up to front office. And anything come up, but they still come see me. I'm sure it happened for like 10 to all the people that knew. They'd go and still, and sometimes we get together and say, it'd be hard going and not telling nothing. We're going to get out of it. But we knew it was going to go belly up, so
anyway.
That's what it was bought for. Because I come around and ask Capper, I used to get together with him and Francis and go out, Frank and Mildred. And I asked him one night, I says, Capper, you came in here. Sell this thing, bankrupt and sell it again. I said, don't bullshit me. No, you didn't do right.
Mm.
But you could stay till the end. Oh, so that's good with you. So I knew.
Is he still living?
As far as I know, he was. Glenn asked me the other day, but I used to have his phone number, and I quit doing that. I got along with him.
Did you? After the breakup, after this place closed, did anybody get together again? Or were all of you that worked there and were all real employees, did you ever get together with it? Capper and his people afterwards?
No, I went to see him. Because he had always invited me. If you ever go to Vesper, Mississippi, he said, the town is yours.
Mississippi?
Yeah.
That's where he was?
That's what he said. That's where he's main. He's got a building there like a palace, a big building.
Big business enterprise?
Yeah, it's kind of around, like he's in the center, but most of the people go in there and ask for him, they'll tell you he's not there, but he's there. So I called him and told him that Gordy Jones, another real employee, was going to go south on vacation and traveling, and he's going to stop and see him, and he says, oh, you do that. So we did, and then they were saying, and we just heard, I can't remember her name, the main secretary, he got in the front door, tell him about him, he wasn't there, he was in Europe.
But he was there?
Yeah, because she saw us and she recognized, she'd been up to Lansing before, she saw us, she said, you guys, wait a minute, I got to talk to you, she covered it up. So she took us to another room, she says, I thought you said he was in Europe. I said, for you guys, he's waiting. You know, so we couldn't find, I don't know what season it was, we couldn't find a room, just to show you how powerful that man is. Couldn't find a room, that we wanted. We found a room at some from God forsaken neighborhood, or I don't know, people nice. We found that little hotel room in there. So we went over there and he says, where are you guys staying? So we told him. Ain't one of us. And he told us there's no room. He says, did you go to Magnolia? I says, yeah. Hotel? They said, no room there. I bet there will be room.
He made a call.
He made a call. He moved the down place.
Oh.
He must have far-flung businesses
then. Yeah, he had all of them in there. Got us a room. I mean, I don't mean a room.
Sweet.
This is like a suite. Yeah. There's a telephone in the bathroom.
Oh,
there, by the time we got there, the refrigerator, probably an 18 cubic foot, big mother, was full of ketchup, which I like. And he had all the beer that Gordy liked. And everything else we wanted was stacked before we got to see. Before we got, because he entertained us at his place there, and then he took us over to his house to pick a car. You know, he had a few cars. So he let us have a big four-door Cadillac to drive around. We went on the train. We was just having a good time, me and Gordy. Yeah, he gave us a big Cadillac. He got it all fixed up right there. He got the gas pumps in that house. He got everything there. He got a black dude there taking care of it. Oil changes and everything, you know, the mechanic and everything like that. So he fixed everything. So then, that's when he was kidding. No, you car, but I want to give you this room so you guys can use it when you're here. He said, in fact, you might even take it to Michigan, you don't have to go on the train. And he said, we got tickets, so no, we don't care, you can cancel them. But yeah, we brought one back. But every place, we went to the Maxwell nightclub, he owns that. It's a beautiful place. Then later on, about what, I don't know, it was the second day, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, he took us to another bar and the thing was closed. And so he's a big man. He only weighed about 270. He was an ex-football player.
Oh.
You know, about 6'2" or something. He's a big man. He pulled back, sat back, stood back, and then he put his foot in the door. I says, Cameron, we're going to get in jail. He said, Ken, this is my goddamn place. You own that too.
Oh.
Went in there, and he gave that help. Because
that
it wasn't
closed.
Supposed to be closed.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It was only not quite 12, and they had closed. It was supposed to be open to 2.
Mm.
And just, you know, he said, you pick up the phone, call, and have that door fixed or put together for the night. He says, and we're going to stay here until closing time.
Mm.
And you serve us. He had those poor girls working and that bartender in there. Every place we went, he owned.
Do you suppose he was able to buy into some of these new things with some of the money he took from Rio?
Oh,
yeah. I keep thinking.
He owned the airport.
Oh, my.
Right there in town.
In?
Vesperg.
What's the town in Mississippi?
Vesperg.
Vesperg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he owned the airport. He took us right through a tour, and that time he took his limousine. He got in because he's got telephones and everything in his car. And we got in that one, and he took us down there, and I thought he was, he drove right through there, and they flagged him down. He said, don't you know who this is? They own this place. If you want to work, you better not flag me down again.
Sounds like something out of
a movie. He was a rough talker. Yeah. I mean, I felt bad for the people when he talked, the way he talked, just because he worked for him, you know. Well, I knew he was, because I seen him over here.
He wouldn't be the person that would really have loyalty to his employees.
No. I wouldn't want to work for him.
How did he treat people when he was in Lansing? Like all your supervisors and other people, did
well,
he treat them kind of ruthlessly?
Sometimes he
too?
got her rough and all that, but he used the union. Mildred was the one that.
Oh, she had to do
the
dirty
work. She's the one that fired him. She's the one.
Oh.
I was set then because I was with her, but I wasn't. But I knew they fired me just as quick as the other ones. They'd go over there and buy him a cup of coffee in the morning and say, this is the last cup of coffee I'm buying, you're done. Pick up your stuff. You've done that for a lot of them.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
This is all people in supervision, you're saying?
All people that
are. And they have no recourse to union or anything to
no. You? No recourse. And besides, it wasn't going to last anyway, but that's the way they did it. If they had a replacement and they know it was going to bankrupt, you know, they should have bankrupted with the ones that are there.
Yeah.
They didn't have to do it the way they did it. Hmm. I hold that against them.
It didn't bother him then what he was doing to the employees who had their life savings and their pension and everything tied up.
Mm-hmm.
They had worked there.
Yeah, that isn't the only place he's done that. We've done it to a lot of them right here in Michigan.
Right, that's what Glenn said. He said this is his job to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, he done it.
Yeah.
I know there's a trailer home manufacturer that he was in Brighton. Somewhere in there he left close.
Nothing.
Yeah, on the street. Took everything.
Look at how he sleeps.
I don't know, but he's got guards all over the place.
Has he really?
Like a Swiss guard, yeah, but the building where he works.
I remember talking to some visitors off and on through the years I was at the museum. People would come in, ex-real employees a lot, and they would say, you know, express the desire that they wish they could have throttled him, you know, shot him when they had the chance and things like that, you know, those that lost everything.
You know, they a lot of them got that thing. I'm surprised you still live.
Glenn said when we talked to him last week that a lot of workers committed suicide.
They did. I even got less. Do you know the transition, if you want to use the word transition, is that from the job you had and then expecting nothing or to what you went. Some people couldn't
make the same.
We had, I can't think of his name too, I don't know, the mechanic that we had at a real, one of the mechanics, I don't know what, but he went to work at Demers Mechanic. In fact, well, I kind of helped him. But the man really didn't have to work. The man had I think his farm was equipment was $140,000, and his wife worked, and if he didn't want to work, he didn't. But it was, he took it too hard. He didn't have that mechanic position he had at Rio. Okay, now this mechanic position was just as nice. He brought all his toolbox, everything set up, and I said, oh, well, this is nice. You'll have something to do now. You know, 50-some-year guy, you know, nothing to do. I think he worked 3 days in the cruise ship.
Oh my. How long had he been at Rio before? His whole life?
That becomes your identity, though.
Yes, I said the transition is to... Yeah. It's still mechanic, right? Yeah. But I guess it wasn't Rio. And you take the other guy, Tim. I put up my sheets in him. But Tim, he got out, and, you know, he's like, here's a young man. I think he was 30-something. He blew his brains too. Quick, no mess. There's quite a few suicides. Quite a few of them, I think, lost it too, and they're not here. They're here, but not
nervous,
full
complete
capacities.
Just more than they could handle.
And so they'd call me, quite a few of them would call me, how do you stand? I live one day and have a good time going and drink, chase women.
I wouldn't want to bet his wife does.
Well, she knows it.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to sit there and worry. Besides, I had already went to work with John Dammer, so, because he told me, that's where to go. And I sent my resume down, but I wouldn't take this up. I said, I'll stay in Lansing. So I got his card, and I had it on, and he had my card underneath his glass, and he said, don't forget to call me as soon as you're ready, because I went to Mexico vacation, I wouldn't have done my other things. But when I come back, these guys were calling me, you know.
Well, they knew a good name when they saw him. You're going to keep track of people that you know.
And then they want to know how you're taking. They thought, you know, I was going to just mope around, I'm having a good time. If I want to go to work tomorrow, I won't have to. I said, Rio ain't going to make me think, that's all there is in life. Sure, we spent, you might as well say you spent two-thirds of your life there. Yeah. I mean, because, work is where you live. You go home for the other third. Mm-hmm. That's about it. I mean, if you're raising a family, you're never home. You got to work.
Maybe some of those other people didn't have a family that... maybe the real was their life, and on the outside, maybe they didn't have as much to fall back on.
Yeah, maybe that's true too. Maybe they weren't quite as attached, being kids, were different, a killer, so I just need the kid back, especially my girl, more than anything. Yeah. They'd kill me before I kill myself. I even thought of it. They took it up hard. And still right now, when we get together, especially on the big one.
August?
They get in the corner sometimes and start talking. They still can't get over it.
Yeah.
And it's, It's the only time I think we're going to talk about it.
Well, we're glad
you know,
that you do.
Usually I'm remembering the things I did, the things I went through, the things I learned the hard way, you know, and also the fun parts, you know, you remember those? Just to reminisce about them, but not to say these that we saw there. That's another era, another dream, you know, you got to...
Kind of like another life on
this. It's another life, it is. You better go on and see what the rest looks like.
You participated in the supervisors group. I forget what...
The steering gear club?
The what?
Steering gear club.
Yeah, the steering gear club.
I went to the sheriff and became president of that, too.
Oh, you did? Uh-huh.
I went to the sheriff's of the industrial club in Lansing and became president of that.
The industrial club of Lansing?
Yeah, that represented all of the industrial.
Right. Right.
Oh, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah.
From all the different factories?
All the different factories, and manufacturing especially. Well, there was an industrial club which was affiliated with the YMCA. I sat in the board of directors of that for years, then I went through the chairs, and then one day they told me, you want to run for president? I guess I might as well run for everything else. So I was president for 1 year. In fact, a year I was president, I think, since 75.
Oh, the same of it, really?
Yeah. So I give Denver the credit that I was already there.
Oh, I see.
And I said, I was president out of Denver. And I think I signed, I don't know how many, 25 year certificates that if you ever see for working in industrial areas, my name is on there because I was the president of the club.
Mm-hmm.
In the real motors, I forget what year I was president, I think it was in the... Well, those guys put me in, I laid on them and all that.
They were the ones that made you the president?
Yeah, well, they voted for you.
They voted for you. They wanted to keep you out of trouble.
Yeah, must be that they
don't have to do it. They like him, right?
There was three or three running, and I said, I'll never make it. These guys are going to say, well.
Oh, they got their mafia.
Yeah, they got their own.
They got their own mafia.
Boy, I did go by a landslide, and I remember that. Yeah, so they had me in there.
Uh-huh.
Every year they had a new presidency. And it's quite an honor because you get the... No, you already know, in my case, I already knew the club because I was a board of directors for years.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew about the club function. But when you become president, then every function the president does of the company, you're with him because you're the president of the company, of the organization mm-hmm. that he backs up, which is his supervision, his management team, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you function with him as the vice president. So it's quite an honor for that year.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Jack Adams was the president. And I got along with him. Well, I got along with all the president, but I got along with him pretty nice. And yeah, come here, come over here, man. Come here. I want you to say this to my speaker, you know. He really used to get me involved.
Mm-hmm.
Especially after you get a few drinks, you better get
him. What was his last name?
Adams, Jack Adams.
Oh, Adams, thank you.
I think he's in Washington, D.C. I don't know if he's retired or not. He came down one time over at Denver Corporation and he knew I was here, so him and John there hooked me up. But the U.S. but he was nice. Well, they all were, except Capper.
The last one, yeah.
The last one.
And Glenn said that club was very important for fostering that field. You were all talking about that at the lunch, too.
Yeah,
that was an important
club. That was great because it kept the unity and it kept, for instance, you and I got a fight over something, you send me wrong with the line, you know, and you over there, we'd get in a hell of an argument because you slowed my production and you thought you were gaining your production. And so we go over there and drink a few drinks and forget about it. Tomorrow will be another day.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all furnished by the company, of course. They had a regular bartender there.
This is at the club?
Yeah.
At the clubhouse?
At the clubhouse, yeah. We had a reserve just for the steering gear. They call it the steering gear room for them. If you people ever went up there, they had a big steering gear in the middle, hanging as a headlight. That's a headlight. It's a lamp.
Oh.
Candlelight.
I wonder where that was put after the place was torn down.
Somebody's got it. Oh, somebody's got it.
I'm glad
the museum knows
where it is.
Yeah.
Do they really?
Yeah. I wonder.
Check up when
you're
done.
That's a beautiful gear. And that was in the middle, and then in the corner we had a bar, and that's where the bartender, and Then, of course, we volunteered. I used to be good at that. I come back in the alley and pour myself anytime. So I volunteered a lot of times for bartending.
But this was upstairs in the clubhouse.
Hmm?
This was upstairs.
Upstairs, yeah. Huh. A big room. We had TVs there, so you could sit in one corner and watch certain programs. We had a lot of the thing. And you were even kidding when we bring some of them dancing girls in there.
No, I didn't. I didn't think you were kidding.
I didn't.
At time we had, I forget. We used to have the one-armed band, they called it, clapped on us.
Oh, the gambling.
Yeah.
Like with the oranges and lemons and things,
yeah.
You see in Las Vegas.
I don't know where they went, but they was up there.
Is
when
they
went down, yeah. But they made us weld them, so they couldn't help them.
No.
They just keep them for
show.
Yeah, show or whatever. Somebody got those. But
slot machines. That's
yeah, I can't remember what. Yeah, what I'm bad for.
That's all I could think of.
Slot machines. Yeah, they. I can't remember what year they were. Yeah, because it used to be all the dignitaries last year used to come out and see us.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was a good PR. You know, it wasn't just for us, for PR and like Terramont, but you know, you had the mayor, you had everybody, the chief of police come up, and they, you know, said, stupid, though. Somewhere or other, somebody, they found out, somebody, you know, the state police.
I think the chief of police,
State police.
But this did add to a community
feeling.
Yeah.
The Rio reached out to the community. Wonder what other things, besides the fun, I wonder what other things Rio might have done for the community. For the city of Lansing.
Oh, they've done a lot of things. They've done helped the Boy Scout girls. I mean, not Boy Scout girls.
Girl Scout girls
and the boys. They've done a lot because I was in the Boy Scout theater for a while, and I could get a lot of things just because Rio said, "Yeah, go ahead. You know, take this, take that, and we'll pay for it." And,
things for handcrafts and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or for a trip.
For trips.
They furnished the milk and the cookies and whatever, the donut. When I was there, I didn't have no problem. I just go out there and they'd give it to me. Across the street, go out to the dairy.
Oh.
You see, there's one across the street.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he was well known amongst us. In fact, I think he used to come to the club too after he closed up. So, I mean, we could get in, they had their accounts. I don't know how they settled it, though. He just went and got the stuff and put it on and give it to the kids. Or also, we'd have a at a small ballroom, we'd have for the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts certain nights, and maybe they'd show them a movie, an educational movie, you know, and then they also treat them to pops and everything. You know, kids go for that. They'll tell a meeting for anything like that.
Yeah.
So they've done a lot of that.
They were the kids and the employees, a lot of them?
Yeah, a lot of them employees and also neighborhood kids.
Neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or whatever, Cub Scout or Girl Scout did.
Like in my case, I probably had anywhere from 15 to 30, depending on what year they get, kids under me there. And they were, probably two-thirds of them weren't even
real kids.
But they're from the area. So that they done. And then it was great for the blood draws, for the Red Cross. They always missed that.
Oh, the blood drives.
Yeah, we used to always have a good blood and perform it right there. They use a small ballroom. Set up the tables, our tables, and put them in there, and donate money. There's charity things like Thanksgiving, they donate, including the employees, not just Rio, because they go and say, you know, we want to make a charitable drive, anybody want to donate for turkeys, and, you know, then they buy so many turkeys, and they take them for these poor families. They make a list.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, like they call me and say, we don't have any poor family. We get it by people you know, word by mouth and say, yeah, well, I got a neighbor creep, Lord Dowdy, and mm-hmm. work, and yeah, I'm going to have a good Christmas, a good Thanksgiving. We've done a lot of that too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a lot of things that they did. I don't know. I know I got involved, but I used to get involved in social, which I probably shouldn't have. I was running around. But anyway, does everybody remember?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the social Rio was good for the city.
Yeah, that I've read all about that kind of stuff all the way from the very beginning. In fact, it was always doing things like that for the community. Yeah.
The schools, the churches, they did help everybody. Mm-hmm. All they had somebody represent come in there and And invariably be somebody that really worked or two, you know, that belonged to that, and they knew about it, so they got stuck in the committee.
Mm-hmm. I know in the early days, according to what I read, that Ari and his family were very civic minded, so mm-hmm. maybe that feeling just
The family never lost its culture,
mm-hmm.
the real family. Whenever it started, I know that's before my time, but whenever it started, that culture was carried down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there wasn't, like I used to tell them, sometimes a newcomer, I says, you see this culture in this division, it's the same culture in the other division. It might be a little different, but the culture, the main culture is there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get transferred from here to here, don't ever feel uncomfortable, because you're not going to lose this country, you're going to gain another one.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes people have a fear of getting transferred, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They try to upgrade and they don't want to, because you know, I don't know about those people over there.
Yeah, I know these people are comfortable here.
Yeah, and Rio wasn't that way. In Rio, you could treat them. You could ask any of them. They said, talk, they thought, just come over here and there. Maybe they wasn't happy because they moved, because they were used to this group. But the culture would be the same over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so no matter where they moved you. I know I floated the company, especially in the last years. I used to float because they'd give me special assignments, and I'd move out.
Mm-hmm.
And I never seen them. I said, boy, this family always, but Capper bought it. I think though, that group instilled friction. If you talk to all the, especially the ones that we had lunch together with, if you talk to them, you'll know that it was a friction created, so that they couldn't get along from this division to the other.
Mm-hmm.
I know I felt it, but it was hard to break us because we knew, you know, we'd slide,
of him.
Slide that stuff off and still do our, you know, go our way. But
mm-hmm.
it did create friction.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a couple questions too. What accomplishments were significant in your career? What do you think happened while you were there that might not have happened if you were there?
Mm-hmm.
Or what important things did you see happen during your time, your years at the shop?
In manufacturing?
Mm-hmm. I think I'm thinking of manufacturing, but I guess I'm also thinking of the human side of it, you know. But manufacturing is just tough.
Well, yeah, when you think of manufacturing, Rio as a coal, which was a great contributing factor in the military, which we needed at the time,
mm-hmm.
from World War II and through the Korean and into Vietnam. And we came in with some different design trucks, design motors, but one of them was the multi-fuel engine that was, you never read probably too much about
it.
No.
The what engine?
The multi-fuel.
Multi-fuel.
Yeah.
What was that?
That's engine that was helped develop with the government research and Rio engineers that will burn anything that liquefies, you know.
Oh, wow.
If you melt butter, it'll burn and it'll run.
For goodness sake.
So you could be in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah. So if you melt it down or liquefy it somewhere or other with heat, grease,
wow.
They had quite a demonstration. Of course, I don't think it was ever open to public, but it is a pretty good size V8 motor, which is now applied in some vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere, I never followed it up. But that patent went out and it's applied.
Hmm.
In case, but they don't, they want, this is extreme cases,
yeah.
Because I seen a demonstration with different types of oils, like lard and
cooking
oil, but you have to warm it up to run, but in cases like steam emergency, you know you do it, you keep going.
Yeah.
But to burn different gases, like, you know, kerosene and stuff like that, you should already liquefy those, it's terrific. And they had a machine in Toyota, amount of RPMs lost because now this fuel is burning, or that fuel is burning, and it's a burning machine.
Was there big contracts for those for Korea and Vietnam through the government?
Yeah.
I was not aware of that. I knew about World War II.
There was a good size story.
Huh.
For us, then we at that time we wasn't making trucks for them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but for us, And then I think eventually they started making trucks for them.
For the Army,
for the military. Yeah, and also for the others that fought with, you know, went on our side. But that was something that was never wrote up too much.
It really hasn't been.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
that was
very
interesting.
Yeah, it's a multi-fuel. Any kind of fuel burn.
Did you ever get anybody, any military person that came back and said, we use these, they really work?
No, only thing is, I happened to read it in a magazine that they was using it. And I said, oh, I know what that didn't
know.
That's the only thing that I saw change outside of all the improvements that they make on the vehicles, it also was incorporated in the cars, you know, because the engineers at Rio were always developing something, you know, research and development was always working.
That's what Glenn said too.
Yeah.
He said if somebody needed something special, then the Rio people would work on it.
If the government is on picture, we worked on it, and we developed it. And it went out, and there's a lot of things that never got leaked out, but and I don't know how you'd ever find it, but there was a lot of things developed in there.
I'm thinking about two of the lawnmowers that after the war, they went into lawnmower production too, didn't they?
Yeah.
But there were lawnmowers even back before that, which surprised me. A power lawnmower, we've got one at the museum that's quite old.
Yeah.
It's a real. Where did they, that makes me think too, where did they test drive their cars, their trucks, their lawnmowers? Test drive a lawnmower, but I mean test it.
The lawnmower was tested right down there in the corner of Washington and Baker, and there's a cellar or a basement in that building, and that's where they tested the motors for so many hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all you need tested. And up on the top is where you assemble them.
Okay.
And they come out either as real or or the blade type, or the reel, the blade. I thought we had another one. No, that didn't come in. That was a snow blower. Because we made snow blowers, though.
That's right, I've forgotten that.
Yeah, we made snow blowers. In fact, I curled them. We had a machine to curl that blade. And then we heat treated our own. We done just about the whole thing here. We heat treated our own blades for the lawnmowers. We done everything right there, and that was. From the corner of Baker and Washington to the next, building, to the next room. That's where they done the heat treating for those things, the salt bath and the whole thing, for the blades. And the only thing we purchased was a rubber wheel, because we made the wheels on quite a few of the mowers, and we purchased a chain and a few other things, but the rest was all manufactured there until we sold it.
Where did they take the trucks out, like the Army trucks, to take them out? Did they take them out somewhere and test them on a track?
They had a grounds. I don't remember where they were.
Testing grounds?
Yeah, they had testing grounds out here somewhere. They have to ask somebody there. I forgot where that's at.
I'd never thought about that before. Last week, Glenn said something about testing something.
Yeah.
And then I got to wondering.
Yeah, they had a grounds to go. And the Army, of course, took them to, I think, Abilene, and done their own testing.
Oh, okay.
But our trucks were tested, I forget what the proving ground were, but they haven't been up there. I never paid too much attention because once they left the
thing. Yeah, it was outside
already. But I know the others were tested in Abilene, which they still do, because that same truck now is manufactured in Williamson.
Huh.
And the Capital Two and died.
Uh-huh.
It's the same truck. Lawnmower, and then the engine, which Glenn remembers, like he was in that other end, the engine test room for the big engines, and they run in for hours before they mounted them on a vehicle. The V8s and diesels, the whole thing, you know. But we used to make the V8 block there, and we used to make the what they call the Comet Engine 6, which is still up to this day, probably one of the best six-cylinder motors made.
Mm-hmm.
And they call it the Gold Comet. We call it the Gold Comet.
In the real old days, they used to just drive the cars around town.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't really do anything real special with them. They went around town, and they were okay.
Yeah, right. They made it around the circle.
Right.
Know.
It's interesting to think over time, from the first way of delivering the car to the buyer, and he had to pay for it before he got it, and then delivering on a two-track road from here to Chicago or whatever.
Right, because Glenn told us his dad used to deliver, that's what he said, his dad used to deliver the cars.
Yeah.
From the old days, the dealer, that was his job. Yeah.
That'd have been nice. I think I would have liked to do that.
Yeah, he drove them.
And we touched upon the fact that when you bought a car in the early days, to buy it might not work when you got it. Maybe if you had to reorder a part, it wouldn't fit perhaps, and you'd have to fix it so it would fit your car.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right. They sold two boxes with your car so that, you know, you might have...
Well, the custom, there was so much custom made.
Yeah.
A lot of them were special designed for that, and sometimes it didn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
So you end up doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But... The real truck was a custom made truck anyway.
Was it?
Yeah, it was all of us. I think we made more special trucks than anything else. Because, what's the name of that actor? The cowboy?
Dale Robinson?
Dale Robinson.
How'd you know that?
I think I know what he's going to say.
Okay.
The things for his horses?
Yeah, he bought the big trucks there. He lived there while we were making the cab for him.
Oh, did he?
Because he wanted, instead of, I think we were making 22 gauge, or 20 gauge, he wanted 18 gauge material. So he come and talked to me and he says, Luis, will your dice take 18 gauge? I said, yeah, I think we would take 16 if you had to. Just open up certain sections and we would draw material. But I said, well, 18 gauge would be no problem.
Now that's heavier, man.
Yeah, maybe. The lower the gauge, the higher, the thicker.
The thickness of the car.
And most of it was 20 gauge in the cab. He went, and then he had his, I forget how many trucks there was now. And he followed them all through. He stayed right here. And then he had the inside, I don't know, the whole plate of the car, but they had all plated with gold, you know.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, the beautiful trucks when they got done.
They were to haul his horses, weren't they?
Yeah,
I understand.
I read somebody not too long ago, maybe a year or so ago, that he still got that fleet.
They still work, huh?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Right.
Wouldn't that be interesting to contact him?
On the road. One time Pepsi Cola, I think, came in there, and they changed 20. Now, they had... They had the old trucks, but their bodies were all, you know, they were going.
Mm-hmm.
But they wanted the same body, so we had to reset all them old tools to run the same body to
make the same
the fleet look the same here. With the ribbed things on the front and all that.
On the front of the cab itself or the horses?
The hood.
The hood.
The hood, I'm sorry. Yeah,
the
hood top. You know, it's called a hood top. And that, and the cab was... they call it the R cab, and then they had the hood top, which just come around and you raise it up. You know, doing this one, this one. And they wanted the same design. I remember that, because I was one of the big old them old eye with the people.
I wonder how much he paid for just one of those vehicles.
I don't remember. That's pretty good money.
I thought he was the cutest thing, so I knew.
he was nice
to deal with?
Oh, Prince.
I loved his accent.
I
know, you'll have to see some of his old movies.
Yeah. They say Sam Corey and those guys are cousins, or distant cousins, so closed doors, that's where we drank whiskey at night with him, in the corner of Baker and Cedar.
Oh, that little bar that was there?
Yeah, well, it's still there, but
Is it still there? Corey's is still there?
Yeah, but it's under another name.
Oh, yeah, okay. Before that, it was something else, like a burn or something.
Rheingold.
Yeah, that's it, Rheingold.
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
That's before my time.
Mine too. I read it somewhere. No, actually, my aunt lived around the corner in a tiny little house.
Mm. Yeah. Rheingold, Elizabeth, what was his name?
Dale Robertson?
No, Elizabeth was the owner.
Oh, of Corey's?
No, Rheingold.
I don't know. I was
his
just...
name, but I used to go there and agitate. That's from my young days. But then the Corey's, bought it. And then I found out when Dale came in, I call him Dale like I know him.
What, really? You got to know him?
Yeah, I got to know him. Yeah. Then he come in and
he's probably
found out that that was relation, so he was staying. Mm-hmm. I think it was Paul who lived out this way.
Mm-hmm.
Up on Waverly, yeah, well, down,
down by
first,
the river.
Yeah.
On this
there,
side.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So then, so he said, "Look, we'll be over there. You know him? Oh, yeah. Used to drink with a bunch of Corys." And he says, "Well, just knock at the door and you're ready. We don't have just us guys with a relation. I see, they don't want us people here running me down." That's where he'd
hide. He wouldn't have had any privacy.
Yeah, then from there, I don't know how, because he was always dressed with his cowboy hat.
I've got a snapshot of him. I should bring it, show it to you.
Yeah, I like it.
He's coming out of Archie Tarpaus, when that used to be the inbox to go in downtown Lansing. Yeah. And he'd been there for a lunch or a dinner or something, maybe one of those public affairs he didn't like too well, but he was coming out of there, and I have a snapshot of him. He's got his
I'd like to see that.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd like to see that, because he's I never thought, I could have told, he told me one day, I wish I know I had him. Because I got to talk to him quite a bit. He's not just an actor, he's smart. I never did ask him, I don't know, maybe he's got mechanical engineering. He knew everything about those vehicles.
Huh.
I mean, he wasn't going to, when you start talking about the intrinsical part of an anything, that means you know something about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't just let me see, you know. He was telling me what he wanted it, how he wanted it.
So you kind of learned everything as you came up through the ranks, didn't you? I mean, you had that training in Seattle where you
worked. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So basically you learned everything else on the job.
Learned everything on the job.
Well, you mentioned there was some kind of journeyman.
Oh, yeah. We had journeyman at the Dolan Dye Maker. Then Rio sent us to, they sent us, we have our own school in there. And I think I took it too. Management courses.
Okay. Well, Rio was the one that sponsored you to do that.
They brought, professors from Northwestern and Michigan State.
Wow. Oh.
And then I was sent to Michigan State for several short seminar courses too, you know, over 20 weeks.
In engineering schools?
Yeah, blueprint reading and whatever that I thought you need and, you know, you think you need, you better brush yourself over and learn a little more because it helps, you know, get quicker visualization of what you want to do than to try to figure it out, then you're losing time. But if you got a little training, it helps you, you know, visualize.
And Rio, the company, helped you take those?
That was only $2 of
credit.
At that time,
It was, but it's hard to work and go to school.
Oh, yeah, I used to have to sacrifice, say, like probably between 8 and 10 or something in the evening.
Yeah.
Which was no problem, but I should sacrifice really a big body. I just go over there, stay home, argue with my wife and kids. It's a change of climate.
What about the below supervision, the regular worker, were they ever offered any opportunity to take courses?
Yeah, we had apprentice courses, like electrical courses, electrician, and then plumbing, and tool and die maker course, actually, was the main. Then you also had the training for machinists. So those people had a chance, too, chance for them to go get into the salary position, because that's how you start.
Yeah.
And then they, they had to be willing to do it and get good marks. They weren't just going to put you in there just because, you know, you were Joe Blow and that.
Mm-hmm.
No, you had to have a certain thing, qualifications to get in, and then once you got in, you better stay with it.
Yeah.
And, they trained a lot of people. You could see a lot of them yet alive that are in their 60s plus or that went through the journeyman schools in there.
Where were those held?
On the job, and also a training session could be in a small room, or we could also hold a clubhouse.
But in the real campus.
And they at that time, LCC still participated, was small, but they'd send you maybe for a class or two down there. And for most of the time, they held right there, the instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And they have for a management course, there's another course, because they bring some professor in, and he'd probably live here. I never checked, but he lived down the state, right? Especially if they come from Northwestern up here.
Mm-hmm.
And she can stay with no problem, because they just come from down here.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a pretty big engineering, even back then, technical divisions.
Right.
Yeah, pretty good.
And, to me, it was a good training place.
Yeah.
I mean, I learned a lot, because I always wanted to learn, so I didn't care what it was. I don't care if it's finances or machine tooling or whatever, right? If they give me a chance, I was there.
Mm-hmm. How did you see the plant atmosphere changing over from the time you started to the time you, like the working conditions, say, from the time you hired in till
how did I see it?
Mm-hmm, the changing working conditions.
You saw it. You didn't see it too fast. Like when I first went in there, we had these people, the job security attitude. Well, this new regime in my time came in, and we weren't that way, you know. Most of them were veterans, or out of college, the ones that couldn't go to the army for some reason or other. And they had a different attitude, you know. So this gang starts sticking together, and kind of, especially if it's talking to me, he says, just leave them alone, just learn from them, but don't bother them.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, their agitation, then you ain't gonna do nothing. So they start changing. Then from that era come in, then you got another era. They come in there with more like crazy time people, you know.
They're,
60s? Yeah, 60s? Yeah, they're smoking a lot of marijuana, and they start getting into LSD. And it's now that started fringing down the age. Now we have people in my age start doing the same thing as these guys, or these women, and I never got into any of them coming over and get out of here with that chunk. I have enough time with 85 proof, let alone that stuff. So then you see that change, then you come in, and after that, then you got the Vietnam era, and that every era, it seems like about every 12, 15 years, a different group changing. But you don't have to change with them, but that's what comes in, and that's what you got to work with.
There's an attitude change.
Mm-hmm. It's an attitude, it's a little bit of everything. And if you were a supervisor like I was, you saw this, you had a hope with it.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got the little butterfly people, you know, you don't know whether women or men. I mean,
they
start coming in. They swing both ways, you know,
yeah.
With wings. Well, you come in there and you got that. But now it's pretty strong. I mean, you have to take them whether you want to or not. It used to be the, they'd come in there and I could tell right away, you know, that the guy was this way or that way. So who did you work for? I don't remember what the, where did you work first? Where did you work with from here? I was working Holt's products. So I knew him, so I called Holt Products. And I went to another home room.
Mm-hmm.
See, that was the interview for the personnel that I got interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
Called over there. Hey, what about this guy? What's he doing on there? He wants a job. Well, Louis, if you want one of those, you can have easy. I said, that's what I thought, so I haven't called. He says, good worker, but he says, maybe your people can. I said, that's why we let him go.
Yeah.
Your people can't.
They wouldn't
adjust
like
yet.
To work with him.
Right
yeah.
Now, he says, I knew eventually he's going to have to. He says,
mm-hmm.
Right now, if you don't think so, no. So I went in a nice way and told him. But I says, God, you know, I just checked your position, just got filled about 12 hours ago. I got out of that one.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, when I've done work on the early years, even before there were people still around, the ethnic background of the workers was very homogeneous. Everybody was from the same white, Anglo, farm background, Protestants. And then over time, you know, all different types of people began to come.
Yeah, we see we got that. I think we got that more probably in the 60s, 70s. Late, we got a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started getting Orientals.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are hard to deal with,
mm-hmm.
especially in the industrial world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about these new Orientals, I don't know how these are, but those first ones that came in, that I guess they call them boat people, what do they call them?
Oh, the Hmongs from Laos?
Yeah,
and
they weren't quite adaptable to that work, but you still had to take them because you know, you were supposed to take so many or put work.
Yeah. But they were from more different backgrounds. They
weren't
used to that.
But they'd never been
background
machine,
and they couldn't understand why you did it this way and they wanted to do it their way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a challenge in that too. And when the migratory workers come in, that was a little tough too. Because they were not used to the most of them were tomato pickers, what are you going to call them?
Mm-hmm.
They're agricultures, but they were.
Right.
So to convert them to that, they have a feeder because they showed a feeder. Because they used to tell me, look, you think you can handle that? Two or three guys there? And I said, no, I can. I said, but it's going to take time because they can't adjust to this. That machine moves, that thing runs. This is going over here, all these caterpillars and
right.
bed bugs and whatever, everything down there. He says, it's a different feel for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to have to take the time if you want to keep them.
Mm-hmm.
Which we had to.
Yeah.
I mean, they just a plain pedestal grinder. If I put a person there to grind, and all he ever done was pick farm fruits or whatever, tomatoes, he was afraid of that wheel turning and him putting that thing against it.
Mm-hmm. And when did they start to come in more?
A lot of them started coming in about the 60s.
Okay.
Right after, some of them were veterans, and then they knew they could go out of the field,
Yeah.
But before, in the 40s, 50s, you never saw too many. Once in a while you saw one. Because they stayed in the fields, so they stayed wherever they was used to working. But when they came back as veterans, then they knew they could go someplace else, and they'd go try it, but they still had a fear.
Mm-hmm.
Now the era has changed because that generation has got kids, and those kids go to school, so they got a different deal.
Yeah.
So you can see the change in any. And me being from way back there to here as supervisor, even in here, you can see the change from about 12 year spans, this change. I wouldn't say 10, but I think it's around 12.
When you started, though, there weren't very many Mexican American mm-hmm. people in the plant at all. No, that wasn't a problem.
No, it wasn't. No, there was not. For whom?
For you?
No. I didn't know anybody.
No, but I mean, they didn't give you a hard time. It wasn't difficult being.
No, you always find somebody say something, but that's their problem. Not only that, if you speak the language, they're not going to bother you.
Okay.
And I would tell them all, especially the guys, if you know something, I'll cut you down. I said, and you read a subject, and I'll read one, and I'll interpret it quicker than you will.
Right. You're educated and smart.
If you think you're just being smart, I'm not going to tell you what, but I said, you know what it is. I says, and don't mess with me.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. Just don't mess with me. I said, I want a person with education to mess with me.
Uh-huh.
And you'd be saying, I ain't never had any problem with them.
Okay.
I went through a lot of them.
Yeah.
But some of them do, but they carry a chip on the shoulder, so that means they ain't going to get along with anybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they'll just use that as an excuse.
Yes, right.
Yeah.
You're using a crush. I used to tell them it's a crush.
Mm-hmm.
No, I never did. Even in service, I went all through the ranks and then I took officer's training school. And the reason I didn't come in officer because they told me I had the war in a year duration. And I was going to stay there all that time.
Well, they wanted you to stay a year after the war.
What
sort of branch of the service were you in?
In the Army.
Mm-hmm.
In the Army. See, I went in there, but I went through all the ranks, and I was one of the DI, those mean buggers you hear on the TV. I was a DI.
You were a DI?
Yeah, and you think those guys are mean.
Yeah,
I've
heard
mean.
They are.
So I was one of those. I worked myself right through that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have no problem, but there's a lot of them dead. I was on a boat, come back, and through a... We were going over to Reno, we didn't know where you were going there. I told you where I was supposed to from. I was standing outside and around one of the parts of the boat there. I heard one of those guys, boy, when they get across, he said, that Garcia's the first one I'm going to shoot.
I think they all say that about a DI or their top sergeant.
Yeah,
when the chips are down.
Yeah, I stood there and I listened to it. Pretty soon the other guy said, I'll tell you what. You can shoot him, but don't shoot him until the war is over.
That's wonderful.
And the other guy said, fuck off. He says, because if we're in trouble, he's the only one that's going to get us. You ain't going to get me, and I'm not going to give myself. He says, that's the guy that's going to get us. So don't shoot him until after the works. I don't know what got there. I heard a lot of them behind my back. Oh, yeah. Especially on the boat when there's nothing to do but talk.
Yeah, and you're worried
and they
about
were just
where
looking,
going.
They were looking, they're going to get that captain, that lieutenant, that sergeant,
And there's a lot of riveting that goes on. My dad, who was from New York, ended up in a troop from with boys from Alabama.
Oh, that's...
And they used to kill him. Oh. You know, they just drove him crazy. In a good-natured sort of way,
yeah.
But no end.
No.
No end of grief.
And there was an antagonism between college-educated soldiers and those that maybe didn't finish junior high school, and there was that antagonism.
Yeah. And the Army's the one place where everybody gets thrown together.
You see, I never told anybody what I was, what I did, what I couldn't do. Because the minute you come, you know, there's some kids come in there, well, I'm a college graduate, you know, what else they see? Well, they just went holy horror on them guys. Because you had more of the other ones than you did to them.
Yeah.
So, you know, they have a chance. So they said, well, what are you doing? Never mind, my business.
And that reflects an attitude, too, if you come in and say, I'm ROTC. In other words, you're expecting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some kind of treatment.
That's right.
Go in that way.
Yeah, they used
that's
to come in there.
That's
the
shop, too.
Oh, yeah. It's the same with the shop. You get a certain guy. He was trained for a manager, now he thinks he's going to be a foreman right away. But you got to work for that. I mean, that foreman, you got to work for that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't fix your foreman just because you think you've got a little amount. So you work, show, prove it, hey, you get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's in any place you work.
Now, when you first started in, after the war, were you living in Lansing already, or were you still out in the farm?
I was still on the farm. I moved in Lansing. After I got the job. Mm-hmm.
Did you work in both? Because a lot of people
said
that they worked in the factory and the farm both.
Not during the day because I was working days.
Right.
But if I had an hour or two and it was nice days, like a long day, you know, sunshine, and weekend actually, if they needed help, I was there too.
Yeah.
Because it was fun. It was different from what I was doing.
Change of pace.
Change of pace, yeah.
Right. And some of the older guys, they said that, and I read also that it helped when times were hard,
you know,
to be on the farm. There's always something to eat.
It's something they always had in. I mean, I can come back after I started living alone in Lansing, and I come back and my mind always picked eggs and whatever, butter, whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as there, I buy it over here.
So when you moved into Lansing, were you still single or were you already met? You still say you're single in Lansing?
I stayed single until about 26. And a woman I got not me. I didn't get married. She got married.
She got Was she a real employee too?
No.
You didn't meet her on the job.
She's an out-of-state woman. She's a foreigner.
Oh, no.
Had to have a passport to come across the state.
She comes, she had a passport. She's out of Rockford, Illinois.
Oh,
yeah.
I know Rockford. Sure, I do too.
She's talks to all the world, so she knows all the languages.
The reason I ask that is because I was talking to somebody on the phone this morning that we're going to be interviewing, and she was saying, I'm trying to think, who was it? She and her husband both worked there. He worked there 39 years, and she worked there 2.5 years.
Yeah.
She said that they met in the factory, and she said, you'd be surprised how many people met and were married out of the factory. She said that for 6 Saturdays in a row, there were 6 different shop weddings.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh, yeah,
that met
there. A lot of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but see, no, I never, not that I couldn't, there was a lot of single women in there, too.
Mm-hmm. There probably still were some women from the war work, too, when you got
there,
right?
Oh, yeah, a lot of them. I dated some of them, you know, but I was already engaged to my wife.
Uh-huh.
But I did date them, but there's nothing wrong with that.
My mother worked there, too, and I remember there being the big strikes at the end of the war, or, you know, after the war, and then before production started again. There was a coal strike and a steel strike and then a rail strike, and the people were out of work. And it seems like, I remember, you couldn't draw unemployment or something because there just wasn't any money coming in, or very little. So my mother went out and got a second job being a waitress till she hopefully would get called back, but that had to be kept a secret. Because apparently if they found out back at Rio,
they wouldn't give her a
fire,
job
she wouldn't get her job back.
Yeah.
No, because somebody was waiting for the job.
Right.
That was true.
But we had to eat. We had to pay our apartment rent, so she was doing something nobody would find out.
If they thought you had another job, you'd sign you right off.
The union wouldn't protect your job then.
No, that fish would be there that much time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, after the war, she'd been there since only 42, I mean, so she wouldn't have had that many years seniority, really.
And after the war, they wanted to give jobs to the returning vets, too.
See, that I was just going to ask you, what kind of, and you were a returning vet, and I just wondered what kind of, a lot of the women wanted to stay then, and some of them had to. So by then, some of them were single support for their families, as grandmother was. I just wondered what kind of an attitude, what kind of problems there were between the vets returning and wanting their jobs back and the women who wanted to hold their jobs.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see too much. I bossed quite a few women.
Did you?
I didn't see no problem. They had to work. I figured they had to work too, and as long as they already had the seniority, doing good work. And the only part I didn't and I think it was over in the war flight with Red and those other guys from the same job performed by a man, he got 15 cents more than a woman. And that used to hurt me because the woman used to produce more than in 8 hours
mm-hmm.
in pieces.
That's what my mother used to talk about.
And they go in there and I felt bad for them because, you know, so I didn't really, I disciplined one day from Aloysia. I think she's still a Hazel Moss. And
she's going to shoot you too?
No, she was a nice lady. She's a hard worker. And I don't know what how she felt, but that day she ran a few parts better than square shears when I went over there. Maybe the tone of voice I used at or something. But anyway.
She's probably already having a bad day to start with.
Either that or something. I don't know. She never did tell me. But anyway, I left. Thinking, you know, all settled. I just told her, you know, she should have been reprimanded, but I wasn't going to write her up or anything. And that was crap. So I walked out, and I don't think they'd gone 15 minutes, and another lady come up and says, you better go get a hold of Hazel. What's the matter with Hazel? Oh, she's passing out over there. She just can't catch her breath. She's crying so hard. And so I went down there, and I got a hold of Hazel. I said, Hazel, what's the matter? Because I used to dance with the bars, you know, and have a good time with her. She was a nice, working hard lady. And she couldn't tell me. She just... For her apprentice, she says, well, I'll take you up there the first day. No, just keep me here. She says, Louis, she says, I took that so hard, what you told me. She says, I just never wanted to hurt you. And I know you don't want to hurt me, but I took it like you did. And I can't get over it. I said, oh, you better get over it. You screwed up those pieces. I told you screwed them up. I wasn't going to write you up. Could have wrote you up. That'd been worse. Yeah, that'd have been on your record. And I was about to write her, because she never messed up. But she never did tell me what was bothering her. She never made a mistake.
Yeah, it must have been something from home.
Yeah, it might have been something personal.
She was single.
I
don't know whether she never told me. And
somebody, a relative may have been sick. It could have been a million things.
And I felt so bad that I never wanted to hurt anybody's feelings that didn't deserve it.
What happens after you write a person up? For something.
It goes on the record, and usually you can remove it in 6 months or a year if you want to, or leave it there.
The employee themselves can remove it?
No.
You can.
I can call up. Or we could call up. And usually if I'm a good employee, I can leave. Because usually that puts up on the alert. It's like giving you a traffic ticket, you know. You go out and get a ticket, and then you know there's so many points.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be on alert not to get another one, because you're going to get points. This one keeps you on alert, maybe it'll straighten up, or you can come over and confess why you messed it up. Because like you said, it might have been a home problem. And once you tell them, then, you know, and we always used to tell them, I don't think any supervisor ever said, you know, if you got a problem, come in and tell us.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll keep you confidential, and we'll just help you get off of it. Because sometimes you talk to somebody, you know, you feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to tell them that. So in this way, if they play a little hard notes, well, then write them up and see me in 6 months and maybe they'll take it off. So they got to behave for 6 months. If you see, say, in a year, but you could take it off.
If they got too many, like got written up too many times, and
three times, I think it was, yeah.
That's like documenting, and it could be then let go.
Then let go, yeah. Or review. Say for instance, a person had 15, 20 years, and then you start reviewing. Why?
Maybe they should be at a different job.
Yeah, either that or what's bothering them. Is it? We're going to be, you know, get some different views. They didn't. Rio wasn't that bad back in the day. I mean, they really investigated. I don't think they were just like some other companies. Dump them, forget them, you know. That's what you say. That we had a good family time for relation. Come in.
Mice with hammers.
No.
Did anybody else in your family work at Rio too? Or was it just you, none of your brothers or sisters or anything?
No, they were too old to go.
other places.
Yeah, Fisher or Flint or whatever.
Because Glenn was telling us all of his brothers and his dad and his grandfather. It seemed like it was a big thing for his family.
Yeah, it was a big thing, but they wanted to go to different places.
Different places.
So, yeah, they could have went in there. Because I was already in there. I was already there.
Right, and you could have helped him out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they chose to go.
I knew the personnel manager. You get to know everybody because, you know.
What about safety in the factory from the time you hired him? Safety for the employee?
Oh, right. I mean, it went...
Until you left.
It went... When I was first there, it was very bad.
Oh, when you first came in 40?
Yeah.
It was bad?
Got hurt on machines?
Oh, yeah. You got to see an arm off or fingers or hands.
Oh.
Or, and especially in the press division.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be real careful because it was just one lever control. There were no buttons or anything like that.
Did you put your hands on it?
You put your hand in, put thing in lever, and you just start putting the pieces out.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's no, by the time I went through all them years, I seen great changes. I seen ladies with both hands come off of here. I seen a guy with both arms come off. I seen arms up to here come off. One dead. Let's see, how many dead did I see? Two, I think. One went through the fork thing went through his body.
Oh.
I think both of the guys remember that. And the other one went through a road where you test the army trucks, you know, the rollers, their wheels are running. He went right through there and the only thing wasn't flat, it was from here up and he could still talk, he had enough of it.
Oh!
But this is nothing, it was just a pair of pants like that, hanging out, so they squeezed him right out. So.
What?
And his wife was expecting a little. She was born. That's the only thing he told me. I was right there talking to him. And before Mrs. Pappin and somebody else would come down with the medics, not me.
Make me feel a little bit better.
Yeah, but I seen some awful.
What helped as you got the later years while you were there? You didn't see as much of that because by then the safety things were in place.
Yeah, everybody said they kept pushing the safety. In other words, think. There are signs all over, think before you. Because the machines haven't got the eyes, you got the eyes.
Mm.
And stuff like that, and they kept changing them.
And some of the machines could be changed too, couldn't they? Put guards on them and things?
Guards, and monitors on them, and different things you can put on them.
Mm-hmm.
Screen protectors. Now it's a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
This machine that we have. Back in that day, with what was coming new, if they applied it, it was great.
Some of the books that I've read said that the big push during the war, that things needed to be produced so fast, sometimes contributed to
some of the accidents too. See, and that big push during the war continued after the war.
Right.
Because they figured it wasn't war, but now they wanted to be parts for commercial use. Now the demand was out there.
That's
so
right.
They pushed and safety was put over there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't remember what year, maybe the rest of the guys can remember. They start thinking about having safety seminars within the departments,
mm-hmm.
company. We have a group and they come in. We start training ourselves to walk in the morning right away and tell everybody, don't do this, don't do that, watch with this. And
mm-hmm.
They're using by word, by mouth, you know, and then try to think, see what things we could buy to make it more safety for the machine.
Mm-hmm. So you became safety conscious?
Well, yeah, I started training that because it was awful to see somebody lose their hand.
Oh, God. Mm-hmm.
I can't imagine. I've seen things.
Or get killed.
Did the supervisors take suggestions, not just about safety, but all sorts of things from workers?
Yeah.
Pretty much on how to change things to make it better
or more
productive?
Yeah, we formed a committee, which was included the steward and the committee man. And supervisor.
The union was involved too.
Yeah, we had to be. The union suffered just as much as they're the bargaining party anyway.
Right.
So
right.
We had a safety committee and the safety tours.
Mm-hmm.
A good housekeeping, because that means a lot too. Because if you haven't got a clean department, you can trip and hurt yourself.
Yeah.
You see guys fall into a machine, knock themselves out.
Because the floor was
something on the floor, a tube of floor they didn't pick up because.
Yeah.
Is either too lazy or figure Joe will do it next, you know, and it's too late. Pick now, you know. Because all the things we have to start teaching, appreciating them, honoring them. Oh man, just, I've seen a lot of them.
Did the factory, the man who was killed, for instance, was there a pension or was there some kind of benefits for his widow or?
Just whatever the insurance was back in them days. Now you don't have this.
And the workers had, didn't we talk about that?
That was from the early days, they had a mutual benefit.
Oh, but
I don't know how long that lasted.
I don't think it lasted long.
That was more in the teens than the 20s.
Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be as, like now, if somebody's hurt at VOC, they're almost
disability.
Always retired
with a disability
pension.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did Rio do anything like that?
Yeah, they had something like that, but
not very well.
No, it's not. It wouldn't compensate for a lifetime.
Yeah.
No way. Yeah.
Or take care of a kid.
No.
That was
yet
to be born.
Yeah. Or put that worker, say he'd lost one hand, put him in another job. Could he continue to work?
Oh yeah, I think they've done that.
They would do that.
If you lost an eye or a hand or fingers, whatever, you still had a job someplace. Because they had different jobs, or they trained you for the other one. That was kind of like a gentleman's agreement. I don't know if I've ever seen it in writing, but it was there.
And it was because of things like that that people wanted to work at Rio.
We had a lot of people that come back to work.
Well, I've seen even letters people writing during the Depression. Mm-hmm. I think I told some of you at the lunch, you know, I was laid off. I'm back on the farm. When can you get me back? You know, when can I come back to work? You know, and any opportunity that they had to get back into that plant, that's where they wanted to work. They wanted it. Didn't matter. They said, I don't care what it is, just as long as I can be there.
That's right. They could use an elevator operator instead of having a man or a woman fully qualified with a physical body. They put one with an arm missing or
doing something like that.
Or maybe one eye lost and some fragment of shot through, you know, the machines. And we had those too. So they put them on elevators or whatever, or little transit cars they used to carry pieces. They could drive one of those or ETs.
I've seen those.
Yeah.
I remember. I was a kid, grew up in that neighborhood.
So. Little gasoline outlet. I mean, there's a lot of things they change. And the person that was doing it would rather even go a ways out because they knew that person needed a job, needed work. So there was not much. I never heard any of them squabble and say, well, I have some odd job, I'm not going to give it up. I never heard that. If I did, I didn't.
That goes back to the family.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think any of the guys in supervision or even workers ever heard anybody complain like that. They always figured that. In fact, everybody felt bad because the person lost, you know, or lost his life.
Yeah.
But I mean,
it's late.
It's 4 o'clock
and we're all getting tired.
I think we need. This has been wonderful. I really appreciate all your input.
I hope it helps some more.